The following Dharma talk was recorded in June 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri, from the retreat called Awakening Joy, taught by James Barris. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. James Barris is a founding teacher of Spirit Rock Meditation Center in California. His popular online course, Awakening Joy, was featured in O Magazine and published as a book in 2012. James's website is www.awakeningjoy.info.
So, made it through the day. As I was saying in one of the groups, the first day of a retreat, no matter how long you've been doing it, is not usually a bliss trip. How many people here were sleepy today? Okay. How many were restless? How many experienced aches in the body? Good. And how about busy mind? Okay. You're all doing great. Right on schedule, as I said in the group. That's what often, not always, but often that's the experience as you come to sit. It takes a little while to land. That's why it's often recommended, if you get a chance to do a residential retreat, to do one of at least 5 days, because it takes about 2 or 3 days to just settle in to the point where there's stretches of mindfulness. Maybe I should have told you that at the beginning of the weekend, so you really could let go of your report card. And it takes a while to detox. I think of it as a detox from stimulation, because we're so used to operating on outside stimulation. You come here and there's not much going on. Oh, must be time to check out. Okay. Or, whoa, all of the stuff going on inside, or your body is still, your internal reality is still in motion, even though the outside is still. So what happens as you're more familiar with the process is that you know that that's part of the deal, and you aren't frustrated or thinking you're doing anything wrong. The beginning of a retreat is really learning to make friends with all of that and not take it so personally. I give myself, when I start off a retreat, usually at least 3 days in my mind to just be as sleepy as I do. I'm still sitting there, but just giving myself that space. And then if I'm still sleepy, I'll give myself another couple of days. It's more a matter of just giving yourself permission and knowing that you're doing the best you can. So I'm really glad that you're here, that you're still here. And even though I said that, a weekend has its own arc, so you might just find yourself a little bit more connected when we come back tomorrow. No guarantees, but that's often how it works. So now I want to continue on this theme of awakening joy, so you get a sense of how this practice works and can cultivate that sleepiness and restlessness and the other stuff notwithstanding. And I want to touch on at least the first few themes, first few wholesome states that lay the groundwork for the whole unfolding of awakening joy or well-being. First of all, to understand where true well-being resides, this is very different from all the messages that we are told where happiness can be found. For a moment, I asked you to do this at the very beginning of today, or maybe it was last night. Connect with when you really feel, when do you really feel well-being or joy? What experience or activities are you engaged in? Just take a few responses. Anyone? Is that?
Splashing in the Pacific on Maui.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool. Splashing in the Pacific on Maui. Okay. Splashing in the water. You can even have a lake around here. I probably feel something like that. But being out in nature and splashing in the water. Yeah.
Not helping somebody else that needs help.
Helping someone else that needs help. What else? Where do you feel? Dancing, yeah. That's often one that's mentioned. Where else? What's that?
Totally random.
Sometimes it just totally random pops in. Good. Where else? Come on. Yes. Playing with your friend's two-year-old. Playing with children. Yes. Very good source. What else?
I was going to say playing with my two-year-old grandson.
Same thing. Playing two-year-old grandson. Yeah. Anything that, different that hasn't been named?
Looking out the window of a plane and seeing the clouds.
Looking at?
Clouds outside.
At looking at the clouds outside, just enjoying the...
Out the airplane
window. Uh-huh. Out the airplane window. Uh-huh. Anything else?
Puppies and dogs.
Puppies and dogs, yeah. Great.
Sitting down at the piano and playing just for my own pleasure.
Yeah, sitting down at the piano playing just for your own pleasure. All of those are experience of real uplift and delight. That's not where we've been told we'll find happiness. And I want to share with you so you understand the conditioning that we're up against. This is an ad called The Gold Shivers that somebody gave to me. Beautiful woman, draped in gold, very happy. This is how it reads. The gold shivers, that electric excitement, that thrilling warmth. Every new piece of gold jewelry ignites it once again. Nothing makes you feel as good as gold. It's a two-page ad. You can see her. What is the real substance of a new piece of gold jewelry? Emotion, pure and powerful. From the first small shiver of excitement when a shimmering necklace of gold beads catches a woman's eye, to the great shivers of delight when the coveted object actually becomes hers. Among life's pleasures, count this deeply felt euphoria as unique. The only way to get the gold shivers is by getting the gold. Now, you might not even care about jewelry, but you see that and you say, wow, I want some too, you know? Or you might say, no, I know better than that. I'm an informed consumer. The thing is, it works. That's the scary part. That's why Coca-Cola will pay millions for 30 seconds of your attention so you see happiness in a bottle. And it starts getting in there, in the brain, as madmen are having us believe. Nobody said their gold jewelry just now. Did you notice? Nobody said anything. It's in being alive and feeling experience. And it is part of who we are, as the two people said who talked about the two-year-olds. We come into this world with that capacity for joy and well-being. If you feed and clothe and change diaper of a little baby and give her or him a little bit of love, what do? They squeal with delight. Wow, isn't the world wonderful? And that's one reason we like being around babies. You were that baby. I want to share with you a picture of Chloe Thomas, who is was born 8 weeks premature, and this is before she had come to 9 months after conception. This is who you really are. This is your true nature. When all your needs are met, this is what comes out. And you might say, well, that was a long time ago. I don't know. Or maybe that wasn't me. This is who you really are. And if you, these days, if you put an adult in an fMRI machine and that adult is does not have pain in the body or stress, that's big, not having emotional or physical stress, what they exhibit, five things in the MRI machine, they are conscious, creative, calm, caring, and content. That's why the stress reduction program that that Bridget was mentioning before, we are removing, when you remove the stress and you remove the obscurations to that underlying reality, what that reality is peace. Peace, connection, love, wisdom, and joy. And other, some other really wholesome states. So you don't have to go looking for or think you've lost your joy, and maybe you'll find it underneath some rock or discover it as a fluke. It's right inside of you, and that's an important thing to understand, just like that taking refuge in the Buddha that we did at the beginning. That's what we're doing of our own true nature. So a few different states of mind that can be cultivated that support that. The first of these states that has made, that makes sense to me right out of the Buddhist teachings, that is the key, is the intention to be happy. The intention for true well-being, to have that at the center as a high priority in our life, just like the Dalai Lama saying in that book, the purpose of life is to be happy. It might sound self-indulgent. It's not. This is what we truly want, but we're often postponing our well-being with some imaginary time in the future when we'll achieve it. When I find the right job, then I'll be happy. You know, and then you might get the right job and, well, it's the next thing that could do it for me. When I find the right partner, then I'll be happy. And you might fall in love, and for 18 months you've got dopamine running through your body, and then when it wears off, it's like, oh, who is this person anyway? And I've been in a great relationship for 35 years now, so I know the value of good relationship, of great relationship. But it's work. It's not easy. You really have to work with it. Or when I make enough money, then I'll be happy. Or when I retire, then I'll be happy. It sounds kind of unfortunate. When I retire, then I'll be happy. Putting your happiness and well-being right at the center of your life is a very important, not self-indulgent, but important decision. Because your own happiness then allows for all the beautiful qualities to move through you. We all want to be happy. Anybody here that doesn't want to be happy? And if you're thinking, well, yeah, sometimes I like to be grumpy, and you're holding back your hand. Yeah, I like to be grumpy. That's just your way of being happy. But if you look and see everything that you do, and you check it out for yourself, as the Buddha would say, just see for yourself, come and see for yourself. Everything that you are motivated to do, I will say you'll likely find comes out of some sense that this will make me feel better, or this will make me feel less bad. So there's something in you that is truly rooting for your well-being. It can be misguided. We can hear or read ads with the gold shivers and saying, oh, that's where happiness lies. Or we can get seduced into habits that don't serve us. But it's really coming from a place inside of you that's very good and pure and wholesome, that is wanting your well-being. So the trick is, the key is, to understand where true well-being and happiness lies. Like I said earlier today, in these wholesome states, or last night, these wholesome states, states of well-being, not the gold shivers. But making that decision at the beginning, or clearly in your heart, to go for this is a key first step. And many people who've been practicing, if you've been coming to retreats like this or done a lot of practice, it's because there's something in you that has spoken to you that you see without even maybe understanding it. This is good for me. And there's something true and good that you can trust about it, because it's activated that place of not only connection with truth, but you see there's a possibility for a deeper peace. That decision starts setting everything forth in the direction of greater and greater well-being. And I want to share with you one story that I've been inspired by from a, it's from a book that was really important for me, called How We Choose to Be Happy by my two friends, Rick Foster and Greg Hicks, who are speakers at the Awakening Joy course sometimes. They did a research project, researching 300, and I think it turned out to be about 320 certifiably happy people over a 3-year period. And they would go to a town and, say in rural Alabama and say, who's the happiest person you know? They go to a diner there. Who's the happiest local person? And people would say, Shirley, she's pretty happy. And then they go and meet with Shirley. You happy? Yeah, I'm pretty happy. And then they would ask if they could speak to somebody, people who knew her in their, at her work or at their, in her family. And if it was a pretty good consensus, they then would say, why are you so happy? What are your secrets of happiness? And they distilled 9 different elements that are not all, some are the same, not all the same as the 10 wholesome states that I picked out of the Buddha's teachings. Many of them are the same. The first one is the same, and that is the intention to be happy. As the Buddha says, everything, intending is karma through body, speech, and mind. Everything starts with intention, or as the Tibetans say, everything rests on the tip of one's motivation. And this is one of those stories, Adele's story. In case you think that, oh, you have to have good circumstances to make this happen, Adele reported, in one horrible 24-month period, my life evaporated. I lost everything. My house burned down to the ground. It was the Oakland fire in 1991, leaving me with nothing, no clothes, photos, furniture, no material reminder of my previous life. During that time, both of my parents died unexpectedly. My husband left me for a younger woman at the same time that my restaurant went bankrupt. My best friend moved to Seattle. Even the dog died. I had nothing. I was so filled with grief that I thought maybe God was somehow preparing me to die. Everything was gone. Maybe this was some monumental lesson in letting go and that I should let my life go too. But as my initial shock began to clear, a feeling that I wanted to live outweighed all of my thoughts about death. I began to see there was hope among the ashes. There was one big opportunity. I had a clean slate. As long as I had to start over and create a whole new life, I was going to create a happy one. I wanted to feel whole. I was sure that I wanted to embrace everything in life, the good and the bad. I wanted a feeling of contentment and to feel rested and gentle. I wanted to feel unafraid, to feel I could handle anything that came my way. And I wanted to feel this way for the rest of my life. In spite of my grief, I could see that this all added up to happiness for a lifetime. And Rick and Greg say, when you're around her, she's really just this bright light. This is often how it happens. We need to often go down to the depths to see that we can have a new direction in our life. And it wasn't like all of a sudden she had that intention and everything was fine. It took her a while to process all of her pain and all of her grief. But having that decision set everything in motion. Now, intention is more than just an idea or a thought or a wish. It's making the decision to do your part and that then life help life or allow life to support you. The intention for true well-being. I'd like to invite us to just experiment with this for a moment and see what comes up for you. So as you sit up, close your eyes for a moment. And just imagine getting more and more access to that place of inner peace. More and more access to that place of well-being, true well-being, however you conceive it. Maybe contentment, maybe joy, maybe peace or love. Getting more and more familiar with noticing all the good in your life. inside and outside. And just imagine over the course of the next 6 months, year, 2 years, opening up to more and more well-being in your life. And what that might look like, feel like, what it would be like for all the people in your life to see you truly shine. And if it seems like a worthwhile endeavor, see if you can get in touch with the decision to do your part to bring that about. No report card, no timetable. Just you show up as best you can to awaken to all the goodness inside and around you. And let life support you in whatever way it does. This is where the magic comes. Your decision to put your well-being at the center of your life, not to postpone it. Everything issues forth from that decision. And the wider context, we won't have time to go through this, but just want you to understand that the wider context is that when you see your happiness and well-being as a gift to everyone around you, so it's not a personal, selfish motivation, but to see that the true well-being and happiness comes from contributing to others. This is in the Buddhist teachings called clear comprehension of purpose, where you are inspired by something that is bigger than yourself. And just to realize that your own true well-being, that's not at the expense of others, the real happiness comes from what you have to give, not what you're getting. This is also called the Bodhisattva ideal, where your own awakening is done as an offering to everyone. So that's the first step. The second step is seeing mindfulness as a key. Mindfulness is the key, the basic tool, I call it, of the joyful life. In the discourse by the Buddha that all of meditation, mindfulness meditation is based on, he starts out by saying there is a most wonderful, a most direct way, usual translation, there is one most direct way to overcome sorrow, lamentation, and grief, and despair, and pain and anxiety, and realize the highest happiness. That is the establishment of mindfulness. That's saying a lot, isn't it? That's why practicing what we're doing here is really the basis of what the Buddha said leads to the greatest freedom and happiness. because as I was explaining it in a group just upstairs, of all the different mental factors, there are 52 mental factors in Buddhist psychology. That's the kind of deck that we're all dealt. There are negative factors, unwholesome factors. There are wholesome factors. There's some that are neither wholesome nor unwholesome. There's one factor that has the property of reducing, weakening all the unwholesome states and strengthening all the wholesome states. That is the factor of mindfulness. When you are feeling confused and frustrated and lost, mindfulness can wake you up and interrupt those thoughts. And I'll share with you actually a good anecdote. This is from my friend Sylvia Borstein. She had was talking at the Awakening Joy course about the power of mindfulness, just to see how this works. And she was describing one evening she was staying in New York, and she had arranged to meet a friend for a theater performance, and she decided to take a bus to get there. As the bus crept along through the heavy traffic, Sylvia started worrying, "I'm going to be late. I'll miss the curtain. My friend will worry about what happened to me. I shouldn't have taken the bus. The subway would have been so much faster." Figuring she could walk faster than the bus was going, Sylvia got off. "And of course, as I'm walking, the bus passes me by. And now I'm thinking, I should have taken a cab." Now, Sylvia's been meditating for years, but she's also, by her own admission, been fretting for years. So it was easy for her to fall into that. She continues the story. She describes running down Broadway in high heels with a cold wind whipping around her. And then she says, "All of a sudden, I have the thought, oh, what am I doing? Oh, I'm grumbling." That's a moment of mindfulness. Up until then, I was caught up in a habit-driven narrative, an editorial comment about what was happening. But the moment at which the mind says, "Oh, Sylvia, dear, you're grumbling," the lens switches, and suddenly the truth of that moment is, I'm a 71-year-old woman running down Broadway in the middle of winter in high heels. That is far out. That is an extremely fortunate thing to be able to do. It changed everything. I felt proud, and I actually hoped a lot of people saw me. That is how mindfulness works. It wakes us up from our trance. Like I said before, oh, having a meltdown, that's what's happening here. Oh, freaking out, okay. And in the moment that you bring some awareness to it, you interrupt those negative thoughts, and there's a little bit more space. So mindfulness weakens the unwholesome states, and it strengthens the wholesome states. It amplifies the wholesome states. Not only does it cultivate, but when you're present for the wholesome states, it strengthens them. And that's why it's the basic tool, because as you cultivate other wholesome states, when you then apply mindfulness to it, to them, they deepen, they intensify, and you are maintaining and increasing them. And that's what we'll be doing throughout the rest of the day tomorrow. So that leads us to the third of these wholesome states. And I put this in a particular sequence that made sense to me. They're all, any one of them can lead to well-being. But when you see them in a particular unfolding, you can see how one leads naturally to the next. And the third wholesome state that gives us a direct connection to joy, usually, is gratitude. The grateful heart is naturally expansive. The grateful heart sees what's right and what's good in the world and in life and in us and in others. And when we can be mindful of that gratitude, so much more is the power. One teacher, one Tibetan master says that gratitude is like putting out your satellite dish. If you're busy grumbling and complaining and saying, oh, this is wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong, there's no room for all the good stuff in your life to be received. But when you say thank you, it opens up your heart and you can actually receive all the blessings in your life. It's really saying yes to life. Now, gratitude, when you are then present for it and express it, deepens. This is basic karma 101. It's one thing to have a thought, a powerful thought. It's another when you express it in words or actions. So when somebody might be feeling appreciative of you, but if you don't know it, you don't get the benefit of it. But as soon as they say, if it's sincere, I really appreciate this about you, when that happens, don't you feel that connection with them? That's something we remember. And in the same way, when we express our appreciation, we feel that connection with others. So you might just, tonight, if you see anybody around who you really appreciate, just see what it's like to say, you know, they're talking about this today, about how helpful it is and supportive it is to express when you're really feeling appreciation. I want you to know I really appreciate you. Just notice, see what it's like when you do that. But even if you don't do it, if you feel it and then let yourself really feel it, you awaken joy right there. As a little exercise, let's just try this. Just close your eyes for a moment. And think of some blessing in your life. Someone or something that you're grateful to or grateful for. And you might have an image of them or of that situation. And as you bring an image into your mind or your heart, give a simple, silent thank you right from your heart. Thank you. To that person or to life, thank you. And now just let your awareness rest in that feeling. Thank you. How does it feel in your body or in your mind or your heart? Take a breath. We'll do another one. bring another blessing to your life, someone or something. Have an image. A simple, sincere thank you right from your heart. Thank you. And then let your awareness rest in that feeling. Thank you. One last one. Take a breath. Bring to mind a blessing. Bring an image into your consciousness, that person, situation. Simple thank you. Let your awareness rest in that. Notice how it feels. Don't try to make anything happen that's not there. Just relax into it. So this is kind of gives you a sense of how mindfulness applied to a wholesome state amplifies that state. Like I said earlier, it's one thing to know, oh yeah, feeling good. It's another to notice, oh, this is what it feels like to feel good. And with this particular theme, I'll just, since it's almost time to go, close with a story that, for me, is really the best gift that has happened through sharing all of this. It's a story about my mother, who can maybe give you a little bit of encouragement that anybody can change. If you go home tonight and you haven't seen it, has anybody seen the video of my mother? Just, oh, okay, good. If you go to YouTube and go to Confessions of a Jewish Mother, the subtitle is How My Son Ruined My Life. It is now up to 360,000 views because she's very funny. And I share the story in the book where my mother at the age of 89 was, I visited her. I was writing the book and writing the chapter on gratitude and had all this research with me on the power of gratitude. It improves your immune system, your relationships improve, you're taking care of yourself. There's many, many physiological and emotional studies or indices of how things improve with gratitude. So I was writing the chapter, and I was visiting my mom, who happens to be, as you'll see in the YouTube, the quintessential Jewish mother, which as it's affectionately known as a kvetch, which is a word that means a complainer. Okay, as she says, Jewish mothers were born to complain. So I was sharing with her all of this research. And I said, wow, what do you think, Mom? She said, that's very impressive. And I said, hey, wouldn't it be great if you did a gratitude practice? And she said, James, I know my life is really blessed, but I've been looking at the glass half empty my whole life, and I don't think I'm about to change. And then I said, just out of curiosity, if you could change, would you change? She said, yeah, if I could, I would, but, you know, don't hold your breath on it. And then I said, well, let's play a game. I said, you can say things one way or another. It just depends how you frame it. You can say, I know my life is blessed, but this darn TV reception is driving me out of my mind. Or you could say, the TV reception is lousy, and I know my life is blessed. You see the difference? She said, oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense, yeah. I said, well, how about this? Every time you complain, I'll just remind you, and you say, and my life is really blessed. Like, oh, it's so cold here in Marina Del Rey, California. And, oh yeah, and my life is truly blessed. So she had the kind of, she passed away a couple of years ago. She had the kind of spirit that she liked to play games. We were playing Scrabble at the time while we were saying this. And I said, okay, she said, okay, let's play it. We had the most amazing week. My sister, who lived right near her, was away for a couple of weeks. So I was spending a week with my mom, and we have a really good relationship. The complaints rolled off her tongue one after another that whole week. And each time I was really mindful. That was my practice, you know. Oh, darn. Why is this? And, oh yeah, and my life is blessed. And we just laughed the whole week. She got it. It was fun. It was funny. And something registered for her. I called her a lot when I came back after those first couple of weeks, which is, unusual for me, calling her that much. Hi, Mom. How are you today? You know. And, you know, it didn't take long. And a friend on the other end also, was playing along with the game. My sister, who has a lot of the same tendency as my mom, when she came back, one of her first comments was, what did you do to Mom? She wasn't particularly thrilled. It took her a while to kind of appreciate it. Anyway, that habit stuck for the last 5 years of her life, until she was 94. The YouTube, when she was 91 and a half, as she says in the YouTube. And what I wanted to share was, what I put in the book, I shared the story, and she, sent me a birthday card. In our family, we'd always, write poems for our birthday. And it was a family tradition. And she wrote a poem to me. She was also losing her eyesight to macular degeneration at the time. So, is a reference to that in this excerpt. She said, this is 7 months later, 90 is just fine with me. I no longer rant and rave about where the world is heading and my exclusive job to save. I wallow in contentment and know that I am blessed, awakening to the joy of living at its best. I'm happier than I've ever been and truly mean each word. The thoughts that cause the worries now all seem so absurd. Though my eyesight has been dimmed, I see clearer than before. The glass is not half empty. It's overflowing, to be sure. If my mom can change at 89, anyone can change. And that's how she spent the last 5 years of her life, just talking about how blessed she was. Even the last year where she had cancer, she was grateful it wasn't painful. But she was going, and the last 6 months she didn't leave her bed. She couldn't get out of bed. And there she was in bed, couldn't read, her eyesight was gone, couldn't see could hardly see, couldn't hear except with the hearing aids all turned up. And there she was talking about how blessed she was. And a couple of weeks before the end, I visited her, I came in one morning and, into her bedroom, and she was very deep and pensive, or it looked to me. And then she opened her eyes and saw I was there, and I said, "Wow, Mom, what was going through your mind? What were you thinking?" And she said, "Well, actually, my mind was devoid of all thought except thank you, God. Thank you, God." I said, "Wow, Mom, can I quote you on that?" And she said, "Will I get a commission?" Always had a good sense of humor. And even at the very end, I said, "Do you want me to read something at your memorial?" She said, "Sure." And she was ready to go. And she shared, among other things, "I don't know how I had such good fortune. What an incredible run I've had in my life. I've been so incredibly blessed." And then she said, "Blessed, it's such a small word, and it means everything." So it's really possible to change. It starts with the intention to bring that change about, being very present and awake and aware of the habits that serve you and the ones that don't, and opening your heart first to see the blessings in your life that you've been given and gifted and that you are surrounded by. Einstein says there's two ways to go through life. One is seeing nothing as a miracle, and the other is seeing everything as a miracle. And I suggest you go for the latter. To notice and open your satellite dish. And then with that, we can start to open to the more difficult aspects of life, which is the next step. And we'll talk some tomorrow and go through a few more of these steps. But the fourth step is seeing how opening up to the difficulties in your life is a direct path to joy. But you need that wider context of gratitude to be able to hold all of the challenges and the sorrows and the griefs and the sadnesses. Not to pretend they're not there, but just to see them in a bigger context. So we'll be doing more of that tomorrow. And tonight, what I really encourage you to do is to see all around you the blessing in your life. The people, if you're encountering people tonight, your home, that you have a roof over your head probably, and food on the table, and if you are relatively healthy, to notice that. If you have health challenges, maybe reflect that you have access to good health care, or that you've got friends, or if you, whatever your situation, just see what is good. Not pretend the other isn't there, but to really let yourself be touched by all the goodness and be very present for it. And express your caring and appreciation to those in your life. And any moments of well-being that you happen to have between now and tomorrow, remember, you might just try that Rick Hansen 6 times 30 seconds as the magic formula. Just start to practice not only knowing you're feeling good, if you are, or feeling okay is good enough, but to really bring your attention to notice, oh, this is what it feels like. All right. So you're in the middle of this process now, and tomorrow we'll keep on practicing and exploring more ways that you can cultivate in a very pragmatic way well-being in your life.